We're going to talk about Nehemiah and some of the inspiration that we can derive from Nehemiah. And Nehemiah is an account that actually is the completion of a project that started many years before. So if you remember, and Brother Chris did a little bit of the history, but the project started under Zerubbabel. They came back and they started the temple. There was some delays. It got resumed under Ezra. There was some delays, and so Nehemiah has the opportunity to finish and complete the full project, both the temple and then also the walls. And in this account of Nehemiah, we have a really great story. First of all, we read about danger, risk, intrigue, failure, and success. All the things that make for a great novel or a great story. But before we actually get into our material this morning, I want to talk about and note a couple of things. And that basically is some of the interpretations that are laid on to the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. I just lay them out on the table first. So when we study the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, some will say that Ezra represents the work of the church, of the harvest, and Nehemiah represents the seventh period or the Laodicean of the church. That's one perspective. And in this perspective, Brother Russell is the seventh messenger. As the seventh messenger, reinvigorates the church with the doctrine of the ransom, even as Ezra had a mandate to rebuild the temple. And then Nehemiah would represent the saints, this side of the veil, completing the walls 52 days in a very short period of time. And in the account of Nehemiah, there was a lot of work going on concurrently, even as there's a lot of work going on in the Laodicean period of time in the church today. So that's one perspective, one view of Ezra and Nehemiah. The second perspective is that they look at Nehemiah as a picture of the completed church performing reconciliation work with the world of mankind. And so in that perspective, Nehemiah is rebuilding the walls, and that represents the completed church preparing mankind for their place in God's eternal kingdom. So the lessons that they draw from Nehemiah's experiences and the decisions that he makes is put in the context of having Nehemiah dealing with the nation of the world in this reconciliation process during the kingdom. So that's the second view. Another view is that Nehemiah is seen as the last stages of the church coming out of Babylon. So Nehemiah leaves Babylon, right? And it's a rebuilding. The rebuilding process Nehemiah undergoes is actually a reforming, strengthening, and purifying of the church in the seventh period. And the opposition to Nehemiah are the adversaries of the church. And they also draw individual and collective lessons applicable to each of us individually as prospective members, but also collectively as the Laodicean church. So there are three different views for you, and I'm sure there's some others as well. And when you look at any particular thing, you will begin to understand that there are layers. And sometimes we start in one layer and we drop down a layer and we mix layers, right? So if that happens this morning, I apologize for that. But I just want to lay that on the table. There are different views. And what we want to cover today is some of the background of the book of the Bible itself, the books of the Bible itself, and its preparation. And one of the things that I hope that you notice is that the very arrangement of the Old Testament helps us in our study and understanding of the interrelationships between the books, the prophets, and the events that are all going on. So if you really think about the Old Testament, you begin to realize that the destruction of Jerusalem was a major point in Israel's history. And so there are a lot of prophets that talk about it going to happen. There are a lot of prophets that are talking about it happening. And there are prophets who talk about what's going to happen in the future. And so then we get into Nehemiah and Ezra with the rebuilding of it, and we have the same circumstance situation there. So, if you're using a smartphone, you're at a disadvantage. But if you have a Bible, please open it up and turn to the very first couple pages where it has the list of all the books of the Bible. Okay? Now, if you know the books of the Bible very well, then you can just follow along mentally. And I'll try to do a word picture here to help you along the way. Okay, so if you got your list, there are 39 books in the Old Testament. But the original Hebrew manuscripts only had 22. So they had to combine a bunch of books to get to the 22. So the books that we know as Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, which is a combination of some of the major and minor prophets, was actually only one book in the Jewish accounts and Jewish records. They also combined Joshua and Judges into one book. They also combined Ezra and Nehemiah into one book. So, and they also put the order of the books in a significantly different order than what we have in the Bibles that we use today. Now, when we look at your list of the Bibles, it's from a Protestant viewpoint, and I say Protestant because the Catholic Bibles have additional books that are not listed in this order. So in the Protestant book, there are 39 Old Testament books. And to understand the context of Nehemiah, it's helpful to understand how the Old Testament books are arranged. So if you just look at the list, you begin to realize that there's a grouping. There are actually several groupings. In the Old Testament, you have the first 17 books, which are historical. And then within that 17, you have a group of 5 and 12. So from Genesis to Esther is the section called history. And you got the 5 books of the law, Genesis through Deuteronomy. And then you've got 9 books, or 12 books, and they're all pre-exile. So from Joshua... you have 9 books that are pre-exile. From Joshua to Chronicles, those are all the events that are happening before Jerusalem's destroyed and Israel's taken away. And then you have the 3 books, Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, which are post-exile. So the exile's already happened. So they're about to return. And then if you go down into the next section, you have 5 books, Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. They're typically called the wisdom books or devotion. And then we get into the last section, which are 17 also. So you've got the Old Testament's broken up into 17, 5, 17. And the last section of 17 have to do with prophecy. So you've got the first 5 of that last group, starting with Isaiah through Daniel, as being the major prophets. And then we get into the minor prophets. We have 9 minor prophets. Now remember I said that there were 9 books in the New Old Testament that were dealing with the pre-exile. Well, there are 9 prophets that deal with the pre-exile. And those 9 prophets are Hosea through Zephaniah. Okay? So you've got a repeating pattern here. You have 17, and in that 17 you have 5 and 12. Okay? So in the second half, we've got 17 of prophecy, we've got 5, the major prophets, and then we got 12. And those first 9 of the 12 have to do with the pre-exile. Well, that leaves 3 more books left, and that's Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. And those 3 books have to do with the post-exile. So just by understanding that context, begin to understand that if you're going to pick up the book of Ezra, Nehemiah, or Esther, you can look at 3 post-exile books, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, and understand they're both talking about the same periods of time. Just by understanding the layout, you don't even have to know what's in the book. You just, by understanding this breakdown, you begin to understand that those 3 books are going to deal with the same period of time. And that's indeed what we find. Now, this breakdown that we have of our Old Testament has to do along lines of genre lines. So, and I basically laid it out for you. There's history, there's wisdom, and then there's prophecy. And even though the books are grouped within that, they also tried to do a chronological grouping. So Genesis first, then Exodus, then Leviticus, etc., right? But when you come down to Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther, the order is not chronological. And I think Brother Chris mentioned that a little bit already. So in chronologically, Esther is actually precedes the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. But yet when you look in the list, it goes Chronicles, then... It goes Chronicles, and then Ezra, and it skips over Esther. And the reason, I think, is if you look at the last chapter in the book of Chronicles, 2 Chronicles, the very last chapter, it's this very same thing that starts with the book of Ezra. So Ezra picks up where Chronicles leaves off, which is why they put the 2 books side by side. But if you actually diagrammed it out, you would have
you would have a period of time in Chronicles, then you've got the book of Esther, then you've got Ezra, and you've got Nehemiah in the history of the books, right? But Ezra in the books also steps back in the time as well. So if you were to break up the book of Ezra into the chronological time that the book of Ezra talks about, you're going to have Chronicles, part of Ezra, Esther, Nehemiah. Make sense? Okay. So that's a little bit of the background. Now, Nehemiah was written for the Jews, returning from exile, and of course, all later readers of the Bible. And the story begins in Susa, which is the, some might say the capital. You know, there's the official capital, and then there's the place that the princes or the kings would winter over. So we're familiar with in Babylon, you have Babylon itself, and you have the capital of Susa, right? So Ezra left Babylon and went to Jerusalem. Nehemiah leaves Susa, which is further east in the land of Babylon. Now, our historians and our experts say that they think the book of Ezra was written about 440 BC. They think Nehemiah was written about 430, and the book of Chronicles was written about 400 BC. So even though the order is Chronicles, Ezra, Nehemiah, Chronicles is actually written last of the three books. Okay, so that's a little bit of the background. Let's take a look at the book of Nehemiah itself. Now, when you look at Nehemiah, you can actually make a logical breakdown of the book itself. And for me, that's really helpful. So you can look at Nehemiah, the first seven chapters. They have to do with the reconstruction of the wall. And within those chapters, we have two separate breakdowns. You have chapters 1 and 2, which have to do with preparation to reconstruct the wall. And then you have the reconstruction of the wall itself, chapters 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And then in chapters 7 through 10, you have the restoration of the people. So those are the two major breakdowns. But we didn't get through all the books yet. There's still three books left to go, 11, 12, and 13. So sometimes it's a separate grouping. You can break Nehemiah into three groups, or you can make the last three chapters as a subgroup of the second one, and it would just be having to do with the renewal of the covenant and then the obedience of the covenant itself. So that's a high-level overview. And let's take a look at Nehemiah chapter 1. And we're going to walk through a little bit of each of these at a high level. And some of us will make some comments in between, and sometimes we'll wait to the end, but we're going to try and pull out some of the lessons that I learned, and some of the lessons that perhaps we might learn collectively. So Nehemiah starts chapter 1, and it has to do with, first of all, the identification of where he is and who he is, and the location. So that's where we know who he is and where he is. And then in chapter 2, well, and still in continuation in chapter 1, we have his prayer about, he receives his brother Hanani from Jerusalem. And we don't know if it's his natural brother, if it's his family, or just what it is. And we also hear about his prayer after receiving news, and then the condition of Jerusalem itself. And this prayer Nehemiah gives is actually a quote, if you will, a paraphrase of something Moses had said in the law. And you find that in Deuteronomy 28. And he says, this is Deuteronomy 28:15. It says, "But if you shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to carefully observe all his commandments and his statutes which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. The Lord will bring you and the king whom you set over you to a nation which neither you nor your fathers have known. And there you shall serve other gods." And then skip me down to verse 63. "And it shall be that as the Lord rejoiced over you to do you good and multiply, so the Lord will rejoice over you to destroy you and bring you to nothing." So that was one of the promises under the law, that if you don't obey, you're going to have this experience. Well, that has to deal with the captivity. But in his prayer, he also talks about the return. And that's in Deuteronomy 30, verses 1 through 3. And it reads, "Now it shall come to pass, when all these things come upon you, both the blessings and the curses which I have set before you, and you call them to mind, and you return to the Lord your God and obey his voice, according to all that I command, that the Lord your God will bring you back from captivity. and have compassion on you and gather you again from all the nations where the Lord your God has scattered you. So when you're reading in the Old Testament with some of the Old Testament prophets like Daniel, Nehemiah, one of the things that they say in their prayers is that we, our people, have sinned and turned away from you. They recognize that God had blessed them when they were under his care, and that he had cast them off because they had stepped out from under his care. So that's basically chapter 1. And in chapter 2, Nehemiah is sent to Judah, and he visits and views Jerusalem. Now, in chapter 2, we're told it's the first month of the year, and he stands before the king. And in verses 1 through 11, we read that he's sent to Judah. And in verses 12 through 20, we read about his viewing of the Jerusalem wall. So, if you turn to Nehemiah 1:1, we are told that Nehemiah is in Susa, which is east of Babylon, in the ninth month, Kislev, of the year. Then Nehemiah 2:1, we are told that it's Nisan. Now, if you, Brother Chris put the chart up, but if you remember the chart, Nisan between Kislev and Nisan is 3 months. So Nehemiah hears from Hananiah, and 3 months of time passes. And then in chapter 2, he's standing before the king. So what did he do during those 3 months of time? And when Nehemiah says he prayed, when was he praying? Well, I think by the record of the prayer, it was Nehemiah's, the prayer that's recorded, was Nehemiah's initial reaction to the news that he heard. Probably when he had some time off by himself, got down on his knees or prostrated himself or whatever, and he expressed and poured out his heart. Now, I don't know about your prayer life, but I know on my own that I don't pray the same prayer all the time. And then again, on the other hand, sometimes I pray a very similar prayer along the very similar lines. And if you are like me, then we're probably also like Nehemiah. So the prayer that's recorded here is probably a variation of the many different prayers that he prayed over the next 3 months regarding his people and the nation of Israel. And I think that this period of time was a period of time of fasting and introspection and reflection, supplication, but also a period of time of decision-making. And I think Nehemiah started in this place of prayer where it's recorded for us in sorrow. But I think he moved from that, during those 3 months of time, from sorrow to decision. It wasn't enough for him just to think, well, you know, Lord, your people and your country and your nation are in ruins. You're despised and you're looked down upon and your name is great and nobody's bringing you honor that you deserve. And we all this has come upon us because we have sinned against you. He moves from that place to the point of, what am I going to do about it? What can I do about this? And I think in our own prayer lives, when we have a problem, that's a pattern that we should follow as well. Here is the problem. We lay it out before the Lord. All right? But now, what do I need to do about this problem? Now, in some of our lives, you know, we put the pronoun incorrectly. We put I first instead of he. So the proper process would be to lay it out before the Lord, tell him our concerns, but we still have the responsibility of dealing with the situation that we're in. And we have a choice. We can do something or we can do nothing. And Nehemiah decided to do something. So if you look at the last verse of chapter 1, verse 11, it says, "Now I beseech you, may your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight to revere your name." Okay? And here's the key. "And make your servant successful today and grant him compassion before this man." And then Nehemiah says, "Now I was a cupbearer to the king." So what I understand from this is that Nehemiah had decided during this 3 months of time that he was going to approach the king and ask him if there's something that he couldn't do to go back to Jerusalem and do something to help, right? But the decision was taken out of Nehemiah's hand. The king asks Nehemiah first. Now, why would God overrule it that way? Well, I've never been under a king before, so I have no idea what that relationship is like. But I can read, and we've heard that some of these kings it's a good word. Sometimes they were brutal. And sometimes they had big egos. And sometimes they just had bad days. And if you got up on one of their bad days, it might not be so well for you. So Nehemiah, being a trusted confidant, almost a prime minister, Now remember under the story of Esther, you couldn't even appear, Mordecai couldn't even appear in the king's palace in sackcloth and ashes. And when Esther looked out and saw Mordecai in there, she sent out a servant and says, "Move, you can't be here, your life's in jeopardy." Those are my paraphrase. So Mordecai leaves, but that was the rule. So here, when the king says, Nehemiah, you're not sick, you're just sad. You weren't supposed to be unhappy in front of the king. And so the king caught his feelings, caught his emotion. And Nehemiah says, "I was afraid, so I said a prayer." Now, when the king asks the question, it means that Nehemiah can respond. So he doesn't have to wait for the opportunity. The opportunity is taken out of his hands. Now he just has to act on the decision he's already asked for. And now this prayer, 11 or verse 1, chapter 1, verse 11, comes into play. Grant me favor before this man. So he responds. He says a quick prayer, a breath prayer. You ever heard the term breath prayer before? It's a simple prayer that you say under your breath in one sentence or two, which is what Nehemiah just did. He says, "I prayed." Now he's not going to get down his knees and bow his head, say, "King, just wait a minute. I got to say a prayer first." He just says this under his breath, right? "Lord, grant me favor before the king." And then he starts out and says, "Okay, king, here's the problem." So Nehemiah prays often. When you read the account of Nehemiah, he does this frequently. He encounters a situation, he says, "Oh Lord, find favor. May we find favor." So I think the quote that best summarizes where Nehemiah is at this place in time is the quote that I ran across a couple weeks ago. It says simply that courage is simply fear that has prayed. Courage is simply fear that has prayed. That's where Nehemiah was. His life was on the line, could be on the line. He prayed about it, and he stepped out in courage. Now, when you continue reading in chapter 2, you notice in verse 9 that Nehemiah has an escort. An army escort and officers on horseback. But if you flip back into Ezra, Ezra refuses the king's escort. And Ezra says to the king, in verse 21 through 23 of chapter 8, Ezra says to the king that the hand of our God is upon all of them that seek him for good. But his power and his wrath is against all them that forsake him, which is why he would not accept the escort. Because he just said that God was big enough, great enough, strong enough, and would bless us in our efforts. I don't need your escort. Now, years later, Nehemiah is offered this escort, and he says, "Yes, I'm going to take it." And Brother Russell has a great article on this. It's reprint 2526. And he says, "In both cases, we see that the right course was pursued, though in some respects the conditions were opposites. Spiritual Israelites need to learn both of these lessons, to trust fully in the Lord's provision, be it great or small, and in no case to refuse reasonable safeguards when under the Lord's providence they are furnished." So it doesn't mean that you have to reject aid because you have faith. If the aid's given, we should accept it, right? But on the other hand, Ezra said, "You know, my actions show my faith. So by accepting your aid, I am backing away from what I just said about the strength and ability of my God. So in that case, I'm not going to take the aid that you're offering. I'm not take the escort." So back in chapter 2, Nehemiah travels from Susa to Jerusalem, which is over 1,000 miles. And we're told in Ezra that it takes him 4 months to travel. And when Nehemiah, assuming Nehemiah makes that same distance, it's a little further, but he has fewer people, so he can probably travel as fast as Ezra did, but even though it's a greater distance. And in verse 12, we're told once he's there, he assesses the walls. And we're told that he starts at the valley gate, and he travels around down by the valley of Hinnom. So if you imagine a simile of a clock, right? 12, and it points on the clock. The valley gate's at, what is it, number 8. And he continues southward, counterclockwise, over to the gate round number 4, and then he returns back to the gate that he starts with. And that was enough of the survey of the condition of the walls for him to know that the walls were in really bad disrepair. So he returns back. And we start with chapter 3. So the first thing that he does is he starts rebuilding the sheep gate. And he assigns specific portions of to work on. So different families and different units have different areas of the wall to work and build on, right? So we find that in chapter 3. So in month 1 of Nisan is when Nehemiah stands before the king in chapter 2. We take the 4 months of travel time that it says Ezra took, that gives us to month 5, which is the month AD. And so in month 5, he arrives in Jerusalem. He assesses the city and he builds the walls in 52 days. So if you take 5 months and you add 22 more days, you're going to be all of month 5 and part of month 6. Right? Follow? So we're in the 6th month now. And this is the month Elul. You can read that in Nehemiah 6, verse 15. But in Nehemiah 7, verse 73, he says that in the 7th month, which is the month of Tishri, which is also the beginning of the civil year, now Nisan's the beginning of the religious year, 6 months later is the month of Tishri, which is the civil year, it says that he dismissed the people and they had traveled to their homes. That's 7, verse 73. So, during this period of time, between the 1st month and the 7th month, the walls are built. So, 4 months travel, he gets there month 5, he immediately starts construction, he sends the people home. And by month 7, the people are back in their homes. So, where is the sheep gate? Why does he start with the sheep gate? So, on the same clock simile, think of the sheep gate as being number 12. He starts there. And he works his way counterclockwise around the wall from 12 to 11 to 10 to 9 to 8, building the wall counterclockwise until he circumvents the whole wall and comes back up to the sheep gate. And that's the order that Nehemiah chapter 3 tells us about the reconstruction of the wall. And in Nehemiah chapter 3, we are told if you count all the gates, there's only 10 gates. Only 10. But if you do a little more research, you find out that Jerusalem had 12 gates. But only 10 are mentioned here. And of those 10, only 9 are repaired. There's one gate that's not repaired. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So in New Jerusalem, we are told that there was 12 gates. And each of the gates had 12 angels. And the names are written on them. And so in Ezekiel's temple, we find that there are only 6 gates. Now, I don't know the relationship between the 6 and the 12, but when I started looking at this, to me it made a lot of sense that there has to be more than 10 gates that Nehemiah chapter 3 identifies. And there are. There's 2 more that he identifies later on in the book. So the 2 gates that are not mentioned in chapter 3 are the gate of Ephraim and the prison gate. And they are both mentioned in Nehemiah 8, 16, and then also in chapter 12, verse 39. So he starts building, and of course, the enemies of Israel are not happy. And that's what we read about in chapter 4. So they have a strategy to disrupt and stop the work. So they start with, in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 4, they start with ridiculing. And verses 4 through 6, Nehemiah offers a prayer, and he continues working. In verses 7 through 8, they threaten to physically harm the workers. So in verse 9, Nehemiah stops and prays, sets sentinels and defenders, and the work continues. And then in verses 19 through 23, we're told that he sets up a system where because we're all spread out on the wall, and we're so thin that we can't defend ourselves, we want a place of rally. So if you hear the trumpet, wherever you hear that trumpet, rally to where the trumpet is. And that was how they would defend themselves. And we're also told that they were so busy working that they didn't change their clothes except for to wash them.
Well, if you look at Nehemiah as being a picture of the church, what do we wear? What kind of clothes do we wear? Robes. Robes of righteousness. So it's a very simple lesson for us that as we are going about our Father's business, that we need to keep our robes clean. We periodically have to take them off and cleanse them, right? It's the examination of self and sin. But we can't take the robes off for any other reason. We got to keep our robes on all the time while we're working. So there's a real simple elementary picture there. So Nehemiah receives two different kinds of threats. One is ridicule and the second one is violence. And that leads us into chapter 5. In chapter 5 we read that not only are the Jews facing opposition from outside, they're facing opposition from inside. So fellow Jews are taking advantage of one another. That's verses 1 through 9. And 9 through 13, Nehemiah rebukes them. And he convinces them to stop. And he says, look at my example. Through 14 through 19, we have the example that Nehemiah is helping out his fellow man. And he's setting the example as a leader that you should be following as, you know, people as well. And then we get into chapter 6. And chapter 6 is about the intrigue of the enemies of Nehemiah. And we find that the wall gets completed in chapter 6. So the enemies try another tactic. Ridicule didn't work. Threats of violence didn't work. So now they try to negotiate and stall the process. Verses 1 through 9. And that doesn't work. So now they say, okay, we're going to find an ally inside of Israel to sabotage. And that doesn't work. It's verses 10 through 14. In verse 15, we read that the wall is completed. But that doesn't stop the enemies. And in verses 16 through 19, we find that they have a plan of intimidation. And so they start a letter-writing campaign against Nehemiah. And the thing you want to know is the escalation of the tactics that the enemy is using. First, he starts out with ridicule, chapter 4, and violence, chapter 4. Then in chapter 6, they stall through negotiation. They have accusations, they have betrayal, and then a campaign of terrorism. But wall is completed. And the role of the captives who have returned with Zerubbabel is taken, and that's recorded in chapter 7. In chapter 8, you have the regathering of Israelites and the reading of the law. And you have the keeping of the law. So after they have read the law, they decide to keep the law. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But begin to wonder, it's like the reaction to the reading of the law was such that most of this information was brand new information to them. And that's a clue as to how far the walls of Israel had fallen into disrepair. Not only had the walls fallen into disrepair, but also, did I lose my voice? But also the whole condition of the nation of Israel. They weren't teaching the law. They weren't reading the law. They weren't following the law. So when the people heard this law explained to them, they had an immediate reaction. They had a visceral reaction, but then they also had a commitment. And that's what we read about in the end of chapter 8, the keeping of the law. Now we're told that they kept a feast. Well, what feast was it that they kept? So we're told in chapter 7, verse 31, that it was the seventh month, Tishri. And we're told in verse 14 that they wanted to dwell in booths. And we're told in verse 18 that they wanted to keep this feast for 7 days. So you put those three clues together and we begin to realize that they kept the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Booths. Now it's also known as Sukkot, Feast of the Ingathering, the Feast of the Lord, or the Feast of Booths. And this particular, according to the law, takes place on the 15th day of the 7th month. Remember earlier I had said at the beginning of the 7th month all the Israelites had gone back home. So they all came back. They heard the law. And in the reading of the law, they found out that they were supposed to be keeping these festivals. And guess what? There's a festival coming up in a couple of days. Let's keep it. So they do. Now, we are not told what day they actually kept the feast. But we can calculate it based on the narrative of chapter 8, verse 18, and chapter 9, verse 1. So if you do the math, we start on the 15th of the month. We had 7 days for keeping the feast. We had one more day for the eighth day, and then we had one more day for the fasting. So you add all those up, you get to the 24th, and that's what the Bible tells us, that on the 24th day, so we know that they backtracked, they actually kept the feast on the 15th, starting on the 15th. On the 24th, they fasted and repented. And that's chapter 9. So we have the confession of Israel and the repentance, and we have the commitment in verse 38. In chapter 10, you have the people sealing the covenant. In chapter 11, you have the repopulation of Jerusalem, 1 and 10. So Jerusalem had been destroyed. The city was there, but it wasn't safe. So very few people would live in the city. So after the walls were rebuilt, the city was now safe, but there's nobody living there. So Nehemiah takes a census, and he says, 1 in 10. I want 1 in 10. So if you just sat right here and numbered, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you get the chance to go to Jerusalem. But it's voluntary. So if you didn't want to go, you didn't have to go. But 1 in 10 were chosen, and many of them did go. And then in chapter 12, or in continuation of chapter 11, you have the identification of the leaders of the people and the servants of the temple. And then in chapter 12, you have the dedication of the temple, of the wall itself. And that's the book of Nehemiah. Now, I mentioned that there's 12 gates. And we don't have time to go through the 12 gates. But if you start with the sheep gate and you work your way around it, and Brother Chris had a picture of the gates, right? You can read them for yourself. You can find maps, whatever. When you look at the 12 gates, it's like the Christian's walk. Each gate represents something differently. And it starts out in the 12th gate, and the construction of the wall started there, and it went all the way around and came back. And looking at it from the aspect of the spiritual church, the sheep gate was the gate which the sacrifices were brought in to serve on the temple. Well, when we think about sheep, I think about the lamb. When you think about the lamb, you think about the Lamb of God, right? So this walk, our spiritual walk, starts with recognition of the Lord Jesus. And then each of these gates represents something else. And entirely, they represent both the kingdom picture, both the seventh stage of the church picture, and also just the individual picture as well. Okay, so that's it on the gates. But I did want to mention something about the gatekeepers. Now, what or who was a gatekeeper? And why would you have a gatekeeper? Well, common sense says that if a gate is a way of passage that restricts with a gate, right? It's a doorway, right? And you got this wall, so the wall is impenetrable. So the only way you get into the city is if you go in through the gate. Well, there has to be a guard at the gate to make sure that only those who are allowed to come in can come in. And these were positions of authority and responsibility, and they also were very trustworthy. So now if you start thinking about the kingdom picture, and there's 12 gates, who might represent the keepers of those 12 gates? So that was one of the first things after the rebuilding of the wall that Nehemiah does, is he establishes and assigns these 12 gatekeepers. And before a city can conduct business, it must be protected from outside invaders, and that was the role of the gate and the gatekeepers. Okay, now let's skip down to let's talk a little bit about some of the things that are inspiring from Nehemiah. When I read about Nehemiah, the first thing that comes to mind is that great leaders are first and foremost great servants. That's the first thing that comes to mind. And you look at Nehemiah, he was a great servant. He loved the Lord, served the Lord. He wanted to go back. He left his position in Babylon. He had a very high position. His passion was for the recovery of his people and the city of his forefathers. So he went there and he restored. So he was a servant, but he also had to serve the king. And he wouldn't have risen to that position of power if he wasn't trustworthy. So in a servant, we see qualities of eagerness to serve, obedience, dedication. And to be a servant, you have to have a servant's heart. My wife works in the school system, and she used to work with a bunch of young men and women that were very abusive. And she'd come home with bruises from being punched and kicked and hit. And I would say to her, I'd ask her, do they know what they're doing? And she said, yeah. And I said, they get one free hit on me. And the second one would cost them. And then it would cost me my job. But I would guarantee you they wouldn't hit me a second time. See, I don't have that servant's heart in that picture. And my wife does. But for us to be servants, we have to have that servant's heart. They also have to be content with the role that they're assigned. And they have to use the skill sets they have. So that's what a servant brings. A good servant brings those skill sets, that mindset. But what about great leaders? What characteristics might a great leader have? And I did a little research, and I went to actually found a website that has to do with business leadership. So I'm going to share some of this, but all of this is written from a business perspective. I want you to just forget about the word business and think about, replace it with the word rebuilding. Nehemiah was in the business of rebuilding. That was his business. Okay? So, one of the first of the essential five characters of great leaders is they have to be flexible. Do you think Nehemiah was flexible? Well, he had a lot of setbacks, didn't he? He had a lot of challenges he had to overcome and go through. He was in a place where he was secure in Babylon, and he had the opportunity to go, so he took it. I mean, that's flexibility, right? So when you're in a leadership role, you have to be flexible. Things don't always go the way we might want them to go. And they didn't obviously go the way Nehemiah hoped them to go. Competitors change tactics. Governments force new regulations on business. Strikes stop the flow of products. And even natural disasters occur. Those are all things that leaders have to deal with. And out of all those things, the only thing that didn't occur for Nehemiah was a natural disaster. Competitors change their tactics. He had regulations on the business, and he had strikes to stop the flow. So Nehemiah dealt with all them, and that's in chapters 4 and chapter 6. The second characteristic is being able to communicate. Now, some are great orators, but oratory is not the only vehicle of communication that a great leader must possess. Leaders who communicate well are those who can share not only their thoughts, but also let their strength and personal character show through in their communication. And great leaders empower those who work for them by defining their goals and showing them how to get there. Now, when I read that, I'm thinking immediately of Nehemiah. He looks at the walls and he says, okay, what's the best way to accomplish this wall? So I'm going to set up a team. I'm going to grab a team of families. And to make sure, I'm going to put accountability check. In here, I'm going to make sure that you build the wall in front of your own house. Because you are the most at risk if that wall is broken. So I guarantee, just by doing that accountability, that you're going to build the wall the best that you can. The other thing he does, if you read through the list of the workers, some are goldsmiths. They're used to working with small things. They're not used to picking up stone and building walls. Some were refiners or makers of perfume. Well, if you're refining perfume, you're not picking up stone, right? So it didn't matter what your skill sets were before. He challenged them to grow in the opportunity and task that they had before them. That's what great leaders do. This is where you are. I believe that you can also do this. Here, why don't you take it on? And I'm going to be there to help you and support you. Now, I see a lot of nods going on, right? Anybody in management and leadership understands that concept. Your role as a leader is to get the work done, but not to do the work. Your role as a leader, our role as a leader, is to make sure that the work gets done by removing the impediments, by making sure they have the skill sets, making sure they have the training, making sure the environment's right for them to be successful. Gee, that sounds like the church, doesn't it? Okay, third characteristic of great leaders, courage, tenacity, and patience. Have you ever walked 1,000 miles through dangerous territory? I haven't. I won't even walk down the street in some areas. Nehemiah travels 1,000 miles. Ezra traveled 1,000 miles without any backup. Nehemiah had backup. Ezra didn't. Nehemiah prayed often. And remember that quote, courage is simply fear that has prayed? Nehemiah drew courage from his prayer. He knew what he wanted to do. He asked God to bless it, and he stepped out. That's what leaders do. They step out. The fourth thing of a good characteristic of a great leader is the combination of humility and presence. You ever talk to someone and realize that their mind is somewhere else? They're looking at you, but they're looking through you, right? And the words are just going in one ear. Well, Nehemiah was present. When the people brought him a problem, he addressed it. And when you read through the book of Nehemiah, notice, pay attention to the pronouns that are used. We and I. We and I. When Nehemiah wants to rally people and do an effort, he used the word we. I am in this with you. Nehemiah picked up the sword. Nehemiah picked up the stone also. He set the example, right? But when it comes to responsibility, Nehemiah used the pronoun I. I made this decision. I made this decision, right? So he's deflecting the responsibility from his team. He's taking responsibility upon himself. And yet a good leader also, when the accolades come, doesn't keep it for him or herself. They pass that on in recognition that those who did the work made it possible to happen, right? So Nehemiah led by example. He scouted, he worked, he encouraged, he addressed the enemies, he made the difficult choices, and he listened to and he incorporated feedback from the men that were doing the work. And the last characteristic of a great leader is being responsible. Again, it's that we versus I pronoun. We are going to do this. We can do this. Come on. Nehemiah really is a changed leader. He had a vision, and he says, come with me as we make this vision become a reality. And I can just imagine him walking up, putting his arm around somebody. Maybe not physically. But come on, we can do this, right? This is only a little bit of wall. I'll bet you and your team can work faster than the team next to you. Competition, right? Who wouldn't bite on that? And the other hand, he says, okay, but this is your wall. This is your house behind the wall. Make sure you do a good job, right? Because not only are your family depending upon it, but all of us. Because if this wall is breached at any place, all of us collectively are in peril. If the wall is breached, all of us are in peril. So when you combine these qualities of leaders with servants, the great things that can happen may not be financial. They may not be business-oriented. They may not be worldly success. It may not be recognition. It may not be respect. It may not even be honor. But far greater is the accomplishment of individual self-control, subordination of the human will for spiritual benefits, the development of godliness, the encouragement of others in their spiritual walk, and a personal foundation of faith that is so strong that it can stand on individually, but also carry the burdens of others when they need your support. That's the great work that servants and leaders combined can do. Now, if you hope to make a success out of your company, there's three more things that you should be doing, according to this business article. It means that you have to work with others. Nehemiah did that. He knew he couldn't build the walls. Nehemiah wasn't a mason. Nehemiah didn't know the area. He didn't know the whole walls. He just went around part of it. He had to rely on those who were there for the expertise to know what to do, and he took their advice. He had to build and maintain teams, right? So he chose a family unit, a very, very strong team to begin with. And he had to develop individuals within the company. So when it came time for Nehemiah to choose people for accountability and authority, guess who he would draw from to put the gatekeepers in place? He would look at the men who were doing their jobs the right way and who were respected already by the community. And those are the ones who already had a natural leadership. Those are the ones he would put into place in the role of leadership. So he assigned areas of responsibility to those who were responsible, and he let them do their job. He was successful because he helped his teams be successful. He cleared the way of obstacles, made available the resources, and he made sure that they received the training. Now, we didn't talk at all about Nehemiah having the law read under with Ezra in chapters 8, 9, 10, etc. But this is how he trained the people, because he wanted them to become self-sufficient. The service to the temple cannot be dictated. I can't make you bring an offering
you can't make me open up my wallet and give a blessing to another or to God. So I have to have that developed within my own heart and desire to do that. And so by teaching the law to the Israelites, something they had not heard before or were very unfamiliar with, he was inculcating in them, this is something greater than all of us combined. And you're not serving me, Nehemiah, you're serving him. And all this work is done for that purpose, that goal in mind. Because this is really about the city of God's people and the restoration of it and bringing honor to God's name. So Brother Russell, in Article 4042, talking about servants, summarizes the article. He says, three important lessons for the Lord's faithful to be sure they have learned are these. One, meekness, humility is primary importance. Two, obedient faith and abiding trust is an indispensable quality. So meekness and humility, obedient faith and trust, and then the third one is love. Love, the sum of all graces, must richly abide and dwell in our hearts. That's the goal of our walk as a new creation in Christ. So when you add the qualities of great servants to the qualities of great leaders, great things can happen. And those great things aren't necessarily great in the eyes of the world, because we're talking about internal changes, this transformation, the sanctification of us individually, but also the church collectively. So, friends, that is Nehemiah, the godly man, most definitely a servant of the Most High God, and providentially raised up by God to do a great work for him and his people. And a picture of the followers of Christ during the gospel age. Nehemiah is a model that we can use in our own lives as we serve God ourselves. And all the leadership things that we see in Nehemiah, we can bring into our own lives. You might say, well, you know, I'm not a manager of people. It's irrelevant. You manage a family. You manage relationships with your friends. You have relationships with your co-workers. You have relationships with your brethren. All those techniques are usable. If I can't do something, doesn't mean that I can't help encourage you who is able to do something, right? It's this teamwork thing. So in Nehemiah, it's more than just the story about the restoration of the building of the walls. It's more than just a man of faith. It's also about a man of action. And that, my friends, I hope, is all of us, men and women of faith, but also of action.